Genius.
The fully realized vision of an authentic American genius.
We need your brains.
Don't you have a brain in your head?
Oh, then I will have to adjust your brain a bit.
Every day, Billy the Brain talks with the best guests in America.
Cool.
About business.
The boss that works for you.
Entertainment. Sports.
Turn now to sports.
And the local community.
Radio keeps its eye on local events.
It's time for brainstorming.
My brain is like mush.
With Billy the Brain.
Sounds like fun. Let's go.
Now, here's your host, Billy the Brain.
Hi, this is Bill Frank, and you're listening to Brainstorming with Billy the Brain. We're on every day, Monday through Friday at 10 o'clock here on KKZZ AM 1400, Positive Talk Radio for Ventura County. You can also hear us streaming over the internet at brainstormingonline.com. My goal is to bring you interviews with thought leaders in business, entertainment, sports, and the local community. Together, we'll listen to what these people say and relate it to how we live and work right here in Ventura. If all of this sounds like National Public Radio, well, you're getting the idea. Brainstorming with Billy the Brain is NPR done right. If you want to join the conversation, you can always call us at 639-0008. If you're out of the county, it's area code 805-639-0008. And you'll want to keep that number handy because we have ice cream to give away in our second half hour today from McConnell's Fine Ice Cream here in Ventura. So the number again is 639-0008. Every show has a theme. Today's theme is People Who Matter. Both of my guests contribute to society on the larger level. My first guest is named by Newsweek as one of the 50 people who matter most on the internet. Thinker, a writer, a columnist, he's going to help us understand where good ideas come from. My second guest is a member of show business royalty, if there is such a thing. She's the daughter of a famous comedian and pioneer of TV. She's also a TV pioneer in her own right. She's a world-famous philanthropist. She's going to tell us about what it was like growing up laughing and the role that humor had in her life. Stephen Johnson, my first guest, is best-selling author of 6 books on the intersection of science, technology, and his personal experience. His latest book is titled Where Good Ideas Come From, The Natural History of Innovation. Stephen's writing has influenced everything from the way that political campaigns use the internet to cutting-edge ideas in urban planning to the battle against 21st century terrorism. In his books, Stephen is also a contributing editor to Wired Magazine, and he writes a monthly column for Discover Magazine. He's distinguished writer in residence at New York University's Department of Journalism. He's the co-founder and editor-in-chief of Feed, the revolutionary web magazine blending technology, science, and culture with truly an innovative interface. Welcome to the show, Stephen. How are you today?
I'm very good. Thank you for having me.
Well, thank you for joining us. We understand that you're on your book tour and you're some secluded place up in San Francisco.
Yes, so. I'm in a radio studio here on day 6 of the Where Good Ideas World Tour.
The world tour. Are you printing T-shirts at this moment?
No, we haven't gotten to that, but I'm sure people are holding up their lighters and yelling Freebird at the end of my signing.
Excellent. Glad to hear it. It is a wonderful book. I loved it from the beginning. The thing that I liked about it, Stephen, right from the beginning, was kind of counterintuitive for me. Most people think of like Albert Einstein or Thomas Edison have that eureka moment, you know, but you assert that flashes of brilliance from lone geniuses are not really the norm. That ideas come from networks or swarms or waves, call it what you will, in a fertile environment and ecosystem. What do you mean by that?
Yeah, well, I've gone through in researching the book, and I've spent more time on this than I have with any of my other books and kind of worked harder on it because the scope of it was so big. And so I've looked at literally kind of hundreds of kind of breakthrough ideas and innovations from science and the creative arts and in technology. And what you see again and again is that, as exactly as you say, that the lone genius having a sudden epiphany is really it's not even that it's the exception, not the rule, it just almost never happens. You know, people like to tell the story that way. It's a nice, you know, the apple falls from the tree and, oh, I've got a theory of gravity. But in fact, if you go back and kind of rewind the tape and watch it slowly, you realize that, in fact, the idea often was lingering for a long period of time in kind of what I call the slow hunch form, sometimes for decades. And it initially the thinker has this kind of sense there's an interesting problem or there's something intriguing, and they kind of keep it in the background for long periods of time, and then they meet somebody or they stumble across somebody else's idea or a new technology comes along that helps them solve the problem or makes it useful in a new way. And that's really the way that progress happens. It's much more of a networked affair and much less about kind of a lone eureka moment.
All right, well, that makes some sense. But help me to rationalize or help me to understand Thomas Edison's light bulb, you know, because he liked to tell the story that it was 99% perspiration and 1% inspiration. He just kept working at it till he got it right. But in reality, even the light bulb was not an isolated discovery, was it?
That's right. I mean, it's true he did do a lot of perspiration. In fact, the book talks a lot about how error, you know, kind of repeated failure is a very important part of innovation, is that people just mess up and they keep making mistakes, and that's part of the perspiration that Edison had. But Edison had a network of people inside his lab who were working on it, but there was also a lot of kind of implicit collaboration between Edison's competitors as well. So there were a bunch of people kind of working on this problem, and they were patenting what they could, and they were trying to keep their ideas secret where they could, but there's a lot of what economists call information spillover, where an idea kind of leaks out of one lab or one firm, and someone borrows it and figures out how to improve on it a little bit. And even in a competitive marketplace, as in the case of the light bulb, there is a lot of competition, but there's also a lot of this network collaboration that happens.
Okay, good. Another example that really caught my attention was the example that you gave about the FBI on 9/11. Agents really had information to stop the terrorists. They had the Phoenix memo about the one-way flying lessons. They were tracking the 20th terrorist in Minnesota, et cetera, et cetera. They failed to connect the dots, however. You say it's more than that, though. It's really a case of various government agencies protecting and hoarding information that caused this catastrophic breakdown, isn't it?
Yeah, I mean, we don't really know if it would have been enough to stop it, but the Phoenix memo, this is a classic hunch. FBI agent Ken Williams in Arizona has this hunch that he's been following for a while, that seems like there are a lot of people with suspicious ties to terrorist organizations who seem to be taking flight school lessons. And so he sends a memo recommending that the Bureau basically track all the visa applications that involve people coming to the U.S. to do flight training. And it gets ignored by the authorities, and it's dismissed as basically a hunch. There's not enough evidence to justify it. And when the memo comes out after 9/11, the authorities say, well, listen, even if we had paid attention to this, it wouldn't have stopped 9/11 because it wasn't, you know, we wouldn't have had time, it wouldn't have exposed the plot. And part of the point is they were right. They were not lying in saying that it wouldn't have stopped 9/11. What needed to happen was that hunch of the Phoenix memo needed to connect with the hunch that the Minneapolis agents had when they had arrested Moussaoui, the 20th hijacker, and they were trying to get a search warrant to search his computer, which did have information about the specific attacks. And the two hunches were never brought together. The Phoenix memo was never connected to the Minneapolis investigation, and so the search warrant was denied. Now, if they had looked at that application in the context of the Phoenix memo, certainly there would have been enough kind of reasonable cause to open up Moussaoui's laptop and take a look at it. And so that, you know, there you have a situation where a hunch failed because, not because of the quality of the idea, but because the environment was set up incorrectly. It didn't allow the idea to circulate and make new connections.
We're talking to Stephen Johnson, everybody, author of the book Where Good Ideas Come From, The Natural History of Innovation. And Stephen, in your book, you break it down that ideas are really almost triggered by a collision between two existing ideas. You just said a moment ago, the classic hunch of the Phoenix memo and the classic hunch of the 20th hijacker. Had they collided, something may have stopped 9/11. We don't know. But you break it down. You've got seven strategies or seven methods by which ideas are percolated, incubated, however you want to go it. Let's go through those seven together, and then I want to play a little game with you, which we call the quick fire, where I give you a couple of great innovations, and you tell me which one of the seven categories it falls into, okay?
Boy, okay.
All right. So the seven are the adjacent possible. Now, this is the difficult one, and it was the biggest stretch for me.
Yeah, I mean, this is kind of a way of thinking about the whole problem of innovation, which is at any given moment in time, there are possible moves that you can make, and there are moves that you can't make, right? You can't invent a microwave oven in 1600, right? It just isn't possible. And so the point of trying to think creatively is to figure out what moves are possible, what are the kind of new things that can be done with the existing technology, the existing ideas, the existing platforms. And in a sense, all the other six patterns are ways of exploring the adjacent possible.
All right. Now, I like the analogy that you gave about a child learning to walk. I've got a one-year-old grandson, just turned 1 year old this weekend, and he's starting to walk. Tell us how that relates to the adjacent possible, because that really brought the idea home for me.
Well, on some level, you're starting. It becomes a kind of a platform where you start to walk, and that unlocks all these other kind of new possibilities. And the same thing happens on an evolutionary level, right? We develop kind of bone structure that enables us to kind of ultimately stand upright, which then enables us to do all these different things as bipedal mammals that weren't possible when we were crawling around on all 4 feet. And so each time you make an advance, each time you kind of unlock a new door, it opens up kind of new doors and new areas that you can explore.
All right. The next is liquid networks.
The liquid network is an environment where there's a lot of fluidity. The classic example, which also involves drinking liquids, is the coffee house of the 18th century, big driver of innovation in that society. Lots of great ideas in business and in politics and in science come from people hanging out, having kind of informal, fluid conversations about a whole range of different topics. And through that kind of productive, generative chaos, a lot of great ideas emerge.
All right. One that you've mentioned before in passing, I'd like you to elaborate a little bit more on. It's called the slow hunch.
Yeah, the slow hunch is that idea that you don't just have eureka moments. It's sometimes an idea will linger in your mind for a decade before it crystallizes into something that's really useful.
Okay. Serendipity.
That's that chance encounter, sometimes the chaotic encounter. Sometimes it happens in dreams, actually. There's an amazing number of breakthrough scientific ideas, really empirically rich, important, profound ideas that came to scientists in their dreams. And it's precisely because in the brain state of dreaming, there's a lot of kind of chaotic scrambling of neurons firing in ways that wouldn't happen during the day, during your waking state. And every now and then, through that kind of chaos of neurons firing in this dream state, a new connection forms, a serendipitous connection forms between, you know, two different ideas that you've had that you've never put together in the same thought before. And the scientist wakes up with this great new vision of how to solve the problem he's been working on.
All right. We're talking to Stephen Johnson, everybody. His book is From Where Good Ideas Come. And the next up is error, or it might be called trial and error.
Amazing number of breakthroughs in science also happen because people's labs are really messy. I mean, it's just, there's so many stories of people who are like, and then I accidentally spilled this and this happened and I tripped over that and then I invented the X-ray. You know, and the truth of it is that error, no one wants to go seek out error. You want to be right more than you're wrong. Error has this interesting effect, which is that it throws you off your kind of usual routine. It forces you kind of against your will to explore a new avenue that you weren't trying to because you ended up doing something wrong, which took you to a new place. And so it kind of destabilizes your kind of conventional patterns.
All right. Next up is acceptation. What is that?
That is a biological term, kind of an awkward word, but a really valuable one, which is that you see this in the history of evolution, you see this in the history of human culture, which is an idea or technology gets ported over from some other field, and it turns out to be useful in a way that the kind of creators never intended it to. So Gutenberg wonderfully had done all this work on metal type and on inks, but he didn't actually have an actual kind of printing mechanism, a press mechanism, and so he went up into the hills of Rhineland, Germany, because it was wine harvesting season, and he saw, while he was sitting there drinking wine with a bunch of these vintners, he saw this ancient technology of the screw press, which had been around for thousands of years, used for pressing grapes. And he looked at it and he said, aha, that's what I need. And so he took that old technology, kind of spruced it up, adapted it to print, and he used it to kind of complete his invention and really change the world.
All right, and last but certainly not least, platforms.
Yeah, platforms is kind of the sum total of this. When you have these platforms that use a lot of these different patterns, that oftentimes are open platforms where people can build on top of the existing kind of structure and take it in new directions. So we've seen this most powerfully recently in software. The World Wide Web is probably the best example. It's an open platform. Nobody owns it. To build something new on top of it, you don't have to ask for permission. You don't have to have a licensing deal. You don't have to, you know, do a big negotiation. You can just come use these open standards and create something new on top of that platform. And That's why the web, because of its open architecture, has been, you know, the rate of innovation on the web has exceeded anything in the history of, you know, kind of media by orders of magnitude. I mean, in just 15 years, it's radically reinvented itself so many times.
Yeah, absolutely has. We're talking to Stephen Johnson, everybody, his book from Where Good Ideas Come From. And now, Stephen, it's time for the quick fire. As I said, we're going to take your seven principles and apply them to some interesting, innovative inventions. And I'm going to start with the microwave. What category of the seven would the microwave fall into?
The microwave is in that kind of open environment. There's a lot of collaboration going on. Importantly, a lot of these ideas are coming out of kind of university environments where people are kind of collaborating and sharing ideas. But then it gets commercialized. I mean, this is the pattern that you see again and again. Is you see an idea that has academic roots in the kind of information commons, but then it turns out to have this commercial application in terms of, you know, cooking dinners that no one really thought about. And sure enough, after time, it turns out to make money for people. But it didn't. The core idea starts from outside that environment.
All right. Let's take another invention, the invention of Velcro.
Yeah, Velcro is one of those crazy things where they're just experimenting with different kinds of fabrics. I can't even remember the full story of it, but basically, like, it turns out to have this property that they didn't anticipate at all, and it turns out to be useful for all these things that, you know, they certainly, when they were designing it, weren't thinking about, you know, hey, this is good, I can use it to, for little kids' sneakers.
Right.
To replace the shoelace.
Well, the fun part of the story, Stephen, for me, is the fact that here's the inventor. He's walking through the fields of Great Britain, and all of a sudden some burrs are attaching themselves to his socks. He sees how the burrs hook into the material, and he goes, aha, have just invented Velcro.
Well, that's the thing. That's a classic acceptation kind of thing, where it's you're borrowing something from a different field. You're borrowing an environment, you know, from actually not just a field, but from nature. And you're looking at these patterns in nature, and you're saying, okay, there's something about how this little burr is able to attach to my sock in a very tenacious way that enables this kind of breakthrough in materials.
All right. Well, you've already mentioned the World Wide Web and Tim Berners-Lee, so we won't go into that. But how about Post-it notes? Here's Arthur Fry. He sings in a church choir. He's got his hymnal book, has a hard time keeping track of where the different hymns are. So he comes up with a low-tack adhesive that he puts on a piece of paper to keep in his hymnal. What of the seven categories does that fall into?
Well, there are a couple things going on there. The first is that they were originally working on glues that would be super strong, and they made a mistake basically, and they kind of failed. And in fact, what they developed was a glue that would be actually not strong at all, and kind of tear on, you know, attach again. There was a mistake that kind of drove that process of innovation. And then you had a mind that was, you know, they kind of needed to find more structure and had this particular need for this technology, you know, a very local need. And through this error, but also through, you know, kind of an inventive reuse of this technology, he was able to kind of, you know, create this crazy object that's now, you know, everywhere in the world.
Ah, that's great. Well, that brings us to the end on the quick fire, Stephen. But I want to ask you, because this is a two-part question. We've only got a couple of minutes remaining. You say that Twitter is really the poster child of open platform movement. What makes you say that? And I'm going to counter the second part of the question is, a fellow writer, Nicholas Carr, who wrote The Shallows, is saying, wait a minute. The internet is making us dumber. We're all kind of going in group herd mentality, et cetera, et cetera. So how can these two things exist? How can an open platform like the internet or Twitter coexist at the same time we're all becoming dumber because the internet is leading us towards mobthink?
Well, I think that, you know, Twitter, I'm talking about, there's been a lot, just the service has expanded and turned out to be good for lots of things that it wasn't originally intended to in a very short amount of time. So I use Twitter to follow the links that people are talking about. The people I follow, I look at the stories they're reading that day. So I use it as kind of a reading list for the day, and I follow an interesting bunch of people. And so I have this very diverse, interesting, in-depth reading list. I mean, it's not the 140 characters. It's the article that they're pointing to that I'm reading. And so I'm able to read really long-form, interesting, stimulating, diverse things because of this Twitter platform, which was not something they designed the service to do, but it turned out to be great at that. In terms of Nick's argument, I think that's a great book, and I agree with a lot of what he's saying, but I think that it has limits. He's talking about how we're so easily distracted by these things, and I feel it. I mean, it is harder to focus on a long format you know, kind of read. It is harder to read a book than it was 10 or 20 years ago. And we have to work a little bit harder to focus now because there's so many distractions. But the, in my mind, that's only, you know, one small cost. And the benefits of connectivity, the ability to share ideas, the ability to kind of research things as I do in writing these books that, you know, are just multiple, you know, different disciplines and historical studies that are so much easier to get to now thanks to the internet, that the benefits to me in terms of connectivity greatly outweigh the cost of distraction.
All right, we're talking to Stephen Johnson, everybody, author of the book Where Good Ideas Come From, The Natural History of Innovation. It is a great read, wonderful book for holiday gift giving, by the way. And you're out on your book tour right now, Stephen. Where tell us a little bit about where the book can be found and what you're doing on the book tour.
Yeah, the book should be available. You know, I've been seeing it right in the front of airport bookstores even, which is a good sign, and indie bookstores and Kindle and all that stuff. And then I'm going to be at Booksmith in The Hate in San Francisco and then heading to Denver and Chicago and St. Louis and Boston this week, and then it just keeps on going.
It keeps rolling from there. Stephen Johnson, it's been great. You're a thought leader in business and in technology. It's a pleasure having you here on Brainstorming with Billy the Brain. We'll talk to you down the road.
Hey, my pleasure. It sounds like a great show.
Thanks so much. Talk to you soon now.
Bye.